Talking today about the philosophy and the theology of Job's friends. So let's define those two words before we jump into the lesson. Words that you might be familiar with. You've probably heard numerous times in this type of a setting. But philosophy, is, as we're kind of looking at it, is a theory or attitude held by a person or an organization that acts as a guiding principle for behavior. A theory or attitude that acts as a guiding principle for behavior. And as we think about theology, theology, according to the Oxford Dictionary, is defined as the study of the nature of God and religious belief. And so what we are looking at today is, and what we're asking is, what was the general theory about suffering and about God that Job's friends held that shaped their behavior, their beliefs? What were their beliefs about God? What were their beliefs about suffering? What were their beliefs about Job that shaped what they said to Job, how they acted towards Job, and shaped their behavior personally? So, this is really the crux of the book, I think, the middle section of the book. So the first question on your sheet was this: as Job's friends try to analyze the source of Job's suffering, what is their main argument? So let's read these three texts as we start out. First of all, let's read from Eliphaz. A couple of these we noticed last week as well, so the first couple questions might seem a little like review. But in Job 4, it says, remember, this is Eliphaz speaking, remember who that was innocent ever perished. Who that was innocent ever perished. Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed. So the main argument, main philosophy of Eliphaz is, if you sow trouble, you're going to reap trouble. Okay? If you do wrong, you're going to receive wrong. That's his philosophy. And he states it here as he speaks to Job. Bildad in Job chapter 8, verses 1 through 4 says, Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, how long will you say these things? He's speaking to Job. And the words of your mouth be a great wind. Does God pervert justice? Of course, what Job is saying is, I'm innocent. I haven't done anything wrong. I'm not being punished for something that I've done wrong. I don't believe that. And he says, you're full of great wind. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert the right? So he has a belief about God here, by the way. Verse 3, what's his belief about God? That God is just. And you deserve this because God is just. Now, is God just? Yeah. So his belief about God is right. His belief about God causing the punishment upon Job is wrong. He's blaming God. God, does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. And then he says in verses 11 through 14, can papyrus grow where there is no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there is no water? While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. Such are the paths of all who forget God. Okay, what do they do with papyrus? What do they use papyrus for? Make paper, right? So they would, you know, let the papyrus grow, cut it down, make paper out of it, other things as well. But basically he says, if someone perishes, it's because they've forgotten God. They're just like the papyrus that grows up and God's cut them down. The hope of the godless shall perish. His confidence is severed. His trust is a spider's web. And then Zophar says this, should a multitude of words go unanswered and a man full of talk be judged right? Should your babble silence men, and when you mock, shall no one shame you? For you say, my doctrine is pure, I am clean in God's eyes. But again, we went through this last week. A stupid man will get understanding when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. Job, you're stupid. You're not right. You're not pure. That is what essentially Zophar is saying. So these are three statements from these three friends, and we can look at more that kind of state what their belief is about Job. We noticed this last week as well, and so we're not going to get into a lot of detail with it, but who do Job's friends also seem to attack in these passages? Job 5 and verse 4. Job, who else? His children, right? Job 5:4, his sons are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate. Not Job, Job's sons. And then Job chapter 8, verses 3 and 4, does God subvert judgment? Does the Almighty pervert justice? If your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for the transgression. Your children died because of their sin, Job. That's the argument they're making. Job 21 and verse 19, they say, God lays up one's iniquity for his children. Let him recompense him that he may know it. And so they're attacking his children. How does Job feel about that? I mean, 10 children have died. And here they are, just a few. We don't know exactly when. Is that days, weeks, later, months maybe? He's hurt by their words. Take a look at a few things that he says that indicate that as we just kind of jump through these texts. Job 6 and verse 14, to him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. Which is an interesting statement, right? Even if I'm a sinner, you guys aren't being very kind to me. You can at least be nice to me even if I was a sinner. Even if I had forsaken God. My brothers, verse 15, have dealt deceitfully like a brook. Like the streams of the brooks that pass away. So that's one indication of how he feels. You've dealt deceitfully with me. You've not been kind to me in what you're saying. Of course, things are going to get even worse as you go through Job. So you look at Job 13, another response of Job. Oh, that you would be silent, and that would be your wisdom. I wish you'd stop talking. You'd be a lot smarter in my eyes if you would just sit there and not say anything. How long, Job 19 and verse 2, will you torment my soul and break me in pieces with words? Things, as if things aren't bad enough, my friends are tearing me down. And then Job says a few things about himself, and we could do an entire study just on Job 29 through 31. But I think what we find Job saying about himself in these chapters is very much in agreement with what Job, with what God had declared concerning Job. Job is upright and blameless in my sight. Okay, he's a good man. And so I want to take a minute to just read through Job 31 for a moment. And I want you to just think about the character of Job. Because I think there's a lesson here as well. It's, first of all, a refutation of what his friends are saying about him. You're a sinner. You're full of iniquity. This wouldn't have happened to you if you weren't a sinner. And not only that, but I think it's an encouragement to us to think about what kind of people we should be if we want to be people like Job. Who are good, upright, blameless people. And so think about some things Job says about himself. Of course, people can say false things about themselves. But since we know God already said this about Job, I think Job's telling the truth here about his character and who he is. So we start, first of all, with Job the man in verses 1 through 12, about who he is as a man, his beliefs and practices. He says, I have made a covenant with my eyes. This is Job 31. Why then should I look upon a young woman? So Job as a man is someone who wants to be pure and doesn't want to engage in any illicit lust. What is the allotment of God from above, the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked, disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? Job recognizes the omnipresence and omniscience of God. He said, I'm not foolish. You know, I know that if I had done things that were full of iniquity and sinful, that God would know that. But he says this in verse 5 of himself, if I have walked with falsehood or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales that God may know my integrity. So Job says, I'm a person of truth. I don't lie. I'm not deceitful. I don't try to be deceitful and dishonest with people. If my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. So Job says, yeah, if I had done sinful things, I would agree that I would deserve perhaps to be punished by that. But he says, my heart doesn't follow my eyes. Okay? And I like that phrase. Sometimes we just, whatever we see, we want. Even if it's sinful. He says, I don't let the lust of the eyes, right, dictate what my heart's going to follow. He specifically talks about in verse 9, if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another. Let others bow down over her, for that would be wickedness. It would be iniquity deserving of judgment. That would be a fire that consumes to destruction and would root out all my increase. So here's Job the man. I'm an honest person. I'm faithful to my wife and to my vows. I'm not someone who's, you know, engaged in, you know, adultery, illicit lust, dishonesty. Then we look at Job, what I would call Job the employer in Job 31, 13 through 15. What kind of man is Job when it comes to, he had a lot of servants, right? He had a lot of people working for him, taking care of all of those animals and things and possessions that he had. So could it be put on his account that he wasn't very fair with his servants, with his workers, people who he employed? Verse 13, he says, if I have despised the cause of my male or female servant when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? So I've tried to be, you know, good to my male servants, to my female servants, to the people that work for me. And if I hadn't been, then maybe that would be grounds. But he declares his innocence there. Then take a look at Job 31, 16 through 23. We look at what kind of neighbor Job is. Maybe Job is, you know, faithful to his wife, sure. Maybe he's honest, but maybe he doesn't care about his neighbors and other people around him. Maybe he could be accused of that. And Job, he goes to that. He says this in verse 16, if I had kept the poor from their desire, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten my morsel by myself, so that the fatherless could not eat of it. But from my youth I reared him as a father, from my mother's womb I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me, if he is not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless, the orphan, when I saw I had help in the gate, then let my arm fall from my shoulder, let my arm be torn from the socket, for destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of his magnificence, I cannot endure. So he talks about, I've tried to look after the orphans, I've looked after the widows, I've looked after the poor. And if I had neglected them, then maybe for that reason I would deserve to be punished. But he declares his innocence there. Jump down to verse 29, by the way, because he goes back to this topic of him as a neighbor. If I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted myself up when evil found him. So the idea is, you know, even when people who didn't like me were punished, I still didn't rejoice even over, I loved my enemies, I think is what Job is saying. I didn't rejoice even over my enemies' destruction. Take a look at verse 31. If the men of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with his meat? But no sojourner had to lodge in the street, for I've opened my door to the travelers. So he's saying, I've been hospitable when people are traveling through. I've been kind and good to them. And so he's declaring his innocence in a lot of different ways. Now look at verse 24, back up. And you have a picture of Job as a worshiper. Maybe Job focused on his family and focused on his neighbors and he was good to his employers, but maybe he neglected God in worship. But Job declares his innocence there as well. In verse 24, he says, if I have made gold my hope or said to find gold, you are my confidence. If I have rejoiced because my wealth was great, because my hand had gained much, if I have observed the sun when it shines, or the moon moving in brightness, so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be iniquity deserving of judgment, for I would have denied God who is above. And that last phrase kind of indicates, I'm not the type of person who's just paid attention to myself and my family and my neighbors. I've also given honor to God. And I haven't denied my God who is above. I'm a worshiper of God. And so we see a picture in all of these passages of Job. One last section there, just the last three verses, verses 38 through 40. I think this is the picture of Job as a steward. If my land cries out against me and its furrows weep together, if I have eaten its fruit without money or caused its owners to lose their lives, let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. This is a well-rounded, righteous man. That's what I want you to see from Job chapter 31. This chapter right here refutes everything that his friends have been saying about him. I've tried to be a good husband. I've tried to be a good neighbor. I'm a worshiper of God. I've been a good employer. I've been good to everyone and done everything that I could to try to be pleasing to God and to love my neighbor. And so what you're saying isn't true about me. He declares his innocence to counter their false accusation. Now, their accusation is, the reason why bad things are happening to you is because you've done bad things. Where else do we see this philosophy in Scripture? This isn't just a Job problem. This happens in other places as well, right? Take a look at John chapter 9. When we studied John, I think we touched on this last quarter. Job chapter 9, John chapter 9, verses 1 through 3. Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents that he was born blind? Right? So what's the thought? Okay. There must be a reason this guy is born blind. Either his parents must have done something wrong, and God's punishing their child because of the parent's sin, or the child did something wrong, and he's being punished. All right, Luke chapter 13, Jesus deals with this same assumption. In Luke chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. There were present, it says, at that season, some who told him about the Galileans, whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. Okay. It's thought that Pilate ordered, while they were sacrificing and worshiping God, Pilate ordered some of the Galileans be clubbed to death. And historically that's mentioned in a couple of places. And so the question is asked by Jesus, do you suppose that these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans? Do you think they were clubbed to death in the middle of worship because they were sinners? We could ask a similar question today, right? We've heard of church shootings where people walk into a church. That happened down in Texas. It's happened in other places. It's happened in schools. And they open fire. And Jesus could very well ask the same question. Do you suppose that these people who were shot while in the middle of worship, that they were worse sinners than everybody else? And of course, Jesus' answer to that is no. No, you're assuming something if you think that this happened to them because they were worse sinners than others. He denies the assumption in both places. In John 9, he says neither the blind man nor his parents sinned. This man's blind because God wants to show you his glory by healing the blind man. God had a bigger purpose And in Luke 13, the answer is no. Okay? So, we might think to ourselves as we look at Job's friends, man, they are so wrong. You know? That's such a wrong thing to assume that something bad happened to someone because they were sinners or they were evil or... But, I want to ask you the opposite of this philosophy. Have you ever caught yourself thinking, I'm a good person, I don't deserve this? What are you saying when you're saying, I'm a good person, I don't deserve this?
We all stand, we all fall short of the glory.
Okay, we're all sinners, and so that is something important.
We can't compare ourselves with other people. We have the scripture, and Jesus is our yardstick.
Okay. All right. Alan, was that a hand you had up there for a minute?
This is a very touchy. Just trying to find something that you did. And God is a Christian life that has brought something on you, and I don't think it's the way it is. Mm-hmm. We just have to realize that there's a heaven. Mm-hmm. We're all hoping that we all get it there. And we try to do the best we can.
Okay. Good. Zip, Daniel?
I kind of have a different one. I look at it like this. We're all God's children, and He treats us, He's our Father. And it's just like us with kids, right? It's kind of a good of the family sort of thing, right? And I don't think God's an engineer. He's already figured out what's going to happen, how it's going to happen. There's a judgment in the end. We're going to be punished in the end or receive the rewards according to what we do. It's already been written, it's done, it's gone, boom, done. But the thing about it is, you know, God has reasons why things are done or not done along the way. It's to guide everybody in a proper direction because there's a plan to be completed. I watched where a mother has given her child up to be cut open, put C4 in there, walked into a building, exploded. Nothing happened to her, that I know of anyway. Okay? There's not much more vile evil than that. Okay? I mean, I spent the better part of a year in the hospital, and it wasn't a pleasant experience, and I didn't really... I'm laying there like, why is this going on? And, you know, and I seen this guy come in, about half his face blown off, part of his leg and his shoulder and stuff, and it's like, this guy has lost pretty much everything. He had kids, wife, and... It made me realize that I just need to get my mind together and get back on track because I have a wife that is stuck with me unless I do.
Okay. So we all have stories of suffering and we've all wrestled with this type of a question. Right? I mean, not all of us have been in the hospital for a year. But different things happen where we wrestle with this type of question. Why did this happen to me? All right, we're going to let Daniel and Mark talk real quick, and then we'll...
I think the idea behind this is, with this mindset, is the idea that you can earn or deserve something, like that you can be so good to get that, and really that's the wrong mindset, and that these are blessings or things from Christ, or... these aren't things that they're gifts, right? The things that we have here on this earth, we have the mindset that these are given to us, we don't earn them. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of the idea that all this is mine, I deserve this, I deserve these things, or something like that.
Okay, good. Mark?
A couple things come to mind. One of them is that we start to begin to think we're better than other people. And the other is like, it's been mentioned a couple of people, self-justification. And we loathe self-justification. I am good.
Okay. Patrick, good. John?
Later on in the lesson, we're not going to get to it, is Matthew 5:45-46. That pretty much nailed the principle which everybody sees through life.
Yeah, good. Good to jump ahead to that, which is on the back page of the lesson there. Barbara? Yeah.
God is no respecter of persons. And every one of us has a design on our life by God. I have nothing to do with you or anybody else that happens around me. And I have a choice to look at the things that happen in my life as a punishment, which I don't believe God does, or an opportunity for me to rise to where I should be in consciousness as to who and what God is and what he can do for me. I think these things that come into our life are an experience for us to learn and to teach us who and what God is and to help us believe, even in this what I am judging according to appearance, as opposed to righteous judgment, that God doesn't do evil things to people. That's not who he is, nor is that what he does. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a good reason that this is happening to and for me. I choose to say for me. And then that pushes me into the realm of, so how are you going to pray yourself out of this one? But at least I'm praying, is my point. So.
Yeah. Those are all, you know, good thought, MBLA. Last one. No, I want to hear from you, Andy. So you go ahead.
Well, just an answer to this argument, when Jesus was called good teacher, he answered, why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone. And so that kind of takes me, then I can't say I'm a good person. I can't use that argument anymore because Jesus already answered it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's good. That goes along with what Grace kind of said, that all sin and fallen short of the glory of God. I have no right to say that I'm good. Here's the point that I want to try to get across with this question and with this thought process when we think that. I'm a good person. I don't deserve that. What we're saying is good people deserve good things. And that is exactly what Job's friends thought. They thought bad people deserve bad things. The polar opposite of that. Your philosophy is no different than Job's friends if you think good people deserve good things all the time. It's just the opposite of what they were saying. And that's not necessarily true. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky, right? Because then we read passages in the Bible that talk about, you know, you reap what you sow. Is there a sense in which there are bad things that can happen to us that are retribution for the evil that we've committed in our lives? I go out and shoot somebody and they put me in jail. I reaped what I sowed. And so there is a sense, and I think that's where we struggle, that there is a sense in which God has put certain laws and government in order so that evildoers can be punished, but we can't think that every bit of suffering is always a source of God's retribution. That's where we begin to think wrongly about and erroneously about suffering. Sometimes, as Barbara mentioned, others, sometimes God has an overall purpose for your suffering that is not retribution. He wants you to learn maybe something from it. He wants others to learn something from it. And we could get into all of that, but I have 2 minutes left. So there are assumptions about Job's character really quickly. I just want you to see there are assumptions. Don't assume that something bad happens to someone because of their character. We need to be careful not to assassinate someone's character without proof. And that's the biggest problem here. They're saying, oh, well, look, bad things happen to bad people, so you must have been bad, and yet they never can offer proof. They never can give something specific about what Job has done. And when we start doing that, we start putting ourselves in the shoes of God and becoming judges about things that we don't know about. So be careful not to assassinate somebody's character without any proof of that. That's what they've done.
We need to not be those types of friends. What are their assumptions about the value of suffering? Seems to be all suffering is just a judgment from God, and you need to repent. Is that always the purpose of suffering and the value of suffering? I think we need to understand that God might have a higher purpose or plan through our trials. We're going through some pretty tough questions. I want to close with a couple of quotes here, and so give me just a couple extra minutes. The whole cycle, this is from Kaufman's commentary, this just summarizes what we're talking about. The whole cycle of speeches in Job is a marvel of human failure to understand. The relation between sin and suffering, Job never for a moment disputed. The thing that confronted Job was that in spite of his integrity toward God and the absence of any gross wickedness that could possibly have deserved the terrible misfortunes that had overtaken him, he was judged by his friends and everyone else as a wicked sinner who was getting exactly what his wicked conduct deserved. And it appears to this writer that one of the primary purposes of this book is that of contradicting that nearly universal fallacy. The false idea that wickedness is at once punished by God with retribution in kind is not true. It was not true in the days of Job, it was not true in the days of Christ, and it's not true today. In Luke 13, which we mentioned, and John 9, which we mentioned, skip on down, the relevance of these New Testament passages is seen in the fact that people suppose the victims of those tragedies were being punished for those sins. And since it was this very fallacy that was so vigorously alleged against Job by the instruments of Satan in this terrible campaign to compel him to renounce his integrity, we must conclude that the doctrine itself is a primary weapon of Satan. It's invented by him and it's continually advocated by evil men. So let's make sure that we're not being Satan's pawns and replicating what Job's friends did in this belief. All right. There's some passages there. I'd encourage you. It's in, what is it, question 11. Read those passages. When you start thinking that, you know, good things always happen to good people or bad things must be happening to bad people, these passages absolutely overturn that idea. And so just read those passages. When you begin thinking like that or you begin talking to people who kind of believe that philosophy. I'm going to leave this quote up here. Go ahead and read it while you're sitting there for a second, because I think it's a good one to end on. Thanks for your attention.